Park Place Meeting, Wednesday afternoon, June 16, 1976. There is a natural desire in people to try and have a shortcut towards any goal which they wish to reach. And many people have the idea that yoga, the practice of yoga, is one such shortcut. The fundamental objective of yoga, as presented in the Upanishads and also by Patanjali, is the realization of the state of kaivalya, the state of aloneness. This is frequently misunderstood by those who have never really understood the significance and purpose of yoga. It's not aloneness in the sense of cutting oneself off from the rest of the world and realizing a unity, a union, or a permanent communion with some entity, Brahman or Atma or some such thing. It certainly is no escape from this world or out of this world into some separate state. This aloneness means actually the full fruition of the particular individual through whom total communion is realized and expressed. This is what is meant by saying that he is a kevala, the alone one. It is the same in the case of the Buddha. He is the alone one, the unique one in that sense, the all-enlightened state is the state of complete universality. So this shortcut idea expresses the mistaken view of those who haven't understood. Many popular books on yoga tend to be very misleading in their presentation. They give the impression that by the practice of yoga, insofar as the postures and breathing are concerned, but especially the postures, one will attain perfection and attain wonderful siddhis, as they are called, psychic powers and so forth. And so they practice these postures in order to become something quite different from other human beings. I have myself witnessed in India some of these students of yoga I am complimenting them, calling them students of yoga, doing all sorts of fantastic contortions in the street, just as a street vendor has his particular place where he is licensed to sell his goods. This man doesn't need a license, but he performs the most remarkable physical antics on the spot where he is. I have seen this in the big cities, particularly in India. Now, we all know that there are usually 8 aspects presented, which covers generally the whole of yoga. And the term Hatha Yoga represents one special formulation of yoga, which covers all the aspects of yoga. The second special limb of yoga is known as niyama, the religious observances, as they are called. And in these religious observances, there is the repetition of the word japa, the mantra. You asked me this morning about mantras. And with regard to mantras, you will find in the Shandilya Upanishad, which gives one of the most complete expositions of the whole of Hatha Yoga, that is to say its philosophy and so forth, and partly also its technique. You will find it mentioned that the repetition of the word aloud produces great good results, but the silent repetition of the word produces results 1,000-fold, 10,000-fold, and so forth. Now, I do want you to understand something in depth in connection with the mantras. First of all, let me put before you what is in the Yoga Tattva Upanishad. It says quite distinctly that one of the several obstacles to yoga, to true yoga, is dabbling in mantras. Now note very carefully, dabbling in mantras. It also says this: now I shall proceed to describe yoga to you. This is from the Yoga Tattva Upanishad. Yoga is divided into many kinds on account of its actions. I think the translator really meant of its activities. Mantra yoga, laya yoga, hatha yoga, and raja yoga. Then he says a few more words about 4 states common to all of them, which we needn't bother about. And he goes on to say, one should practice the mantra along with the proper intonations of the sounds for a period of 12 years. Then he gradually obtains wisdom along with various psychic powers. The very next sentence says, persons of weak intellect who are the least qualified for yoga practice this. That's a tremendous statement to come from that very important Yoga Upanishad. There is persons of weak intellect who are the least qualified for yoga practice mantra yoga, specially. Then he talks about laya yoga, that it tends towards the absorption of the mind and is described in various ways, and so on and so on. Now, with respect to the use of the mantra and when and where and how it can be used, Yajnavalkya, the prince of yogis, is the teacher in this Upanishad, which is called the Tarasara Upanishad. Tarasara means going across. It treats of the essence for going across the ocean of samsara, of the fluctuations of the mind. That is the ocean of samsara. The mind being tossed about hither, thither, this way, that way. And it is Brihaspati who asks Yajnavalkya about this. He is also called Bharadvaja. And he asks Yajnavalkya, what is Taraka? What is that which causes one to cross over to the other shore from this mundane existence? The mundane existence representing, standing for this continuously fluctuating mind. This mind which is unsteady. To which Yajnavalkya replied, and he says this to Bharadvaja simply because Bharadvaja was ready for this. When you get the wonderful conversations between Yajnavalkya and Maitreya or King Janaka or any of the great teachers and Brahmins who came to Yajnavalkya as related in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you get different answers according to what the person himself is. Here, Yajnavalkya says, Om Namo Narayanaya is the Taraka, the means for crossing over. This mantra should be worshipped as Chit Atma. That means the ultimate reality regarded as total attentiveness, total consciousness, Chit. Om is a single syllable and of the nature of Atma, the subjective term for ultimate reality, the term which answers, which is the final answer to the question, who am I? Nama is of two syllables and is of the nature of prakruti, primordial nature, or primordial matter, if you like. Narayanaya is of five syllables and is of the nature of Parabrahman, Now, many people translate Parabrahman as beyond Brahman, which is a slightly it's a logical absurdity. You can't have anything beyond the absolute. It is only the word, that prefix para there does not mean beyond or more than, but it's only a prefix which intensifies the term Brahman, like we can say very God of very God. Parabrahman is supreme Brahman, the absolute Brahman, so to say. Slightly tautological, but there we are. He who knows this becomes immortal. True Om is Brahma produced. Brahma is the Creator God, God the Father. Brahma in reality, for people like ourselves, if we want to understand this, represents the creative energy, the primordial creative energy, functioning in terms of producing phenomena, producing appearances, bringing manifested things, situations, and so on into being. That is Brahma, God the Father. Through Na, the syllable Na, Vishnu, the preserver, the maintainer, is produced. Note what he says, is produced by the syllable. So, through Ma is Rudra, who is which was the original name for Shiva. Rudra is produced. Rudra is usually regarded as the destroyer. The name literally means the roarer, he who roars. Shiva is translated as destroyer regenerator. If we translate Shiva as reabsorber through dissolution and then regenerator, we'll get a clearer insight into the meaning of Shiva. The term destruction in the English language is so associated with the idea of annihilation that it misleads us if we think of this aspect of the primordial creative energy as destructive in the sense of annihilating. Because that which eternally is cannot annihilate itself. It is self-existent. So through Ma, Rudra is produced. The dissolving and reabsorbing and regenerating energy. Through Na, the syllable Na, Ishvara is produced. Ishvara is about the nearest equivalent to the theistic idea of God as a personal being, a personal entity. But remember that for ancient India, this idea of God as a personal being or entity is associated with the idea, with the fact of the release of power in the individual himself who has crossed to the other shore. He can now handle power. Power of the mind, the power of consciousness. Aishvara. True Ra, Ra is the under Virat, as they call it, or the Virat of the universe. That term Virat I find very difficult to translate into English, which would be reasonably close to the original. It is associated with the idea of ahankara, that which produces the self-conception, the power of looking within ourselves and recognizing oneself as an entity which is just itself specific and unique. That is the ahankara, the self-sense in its inner reality. Now, Virat is the term which stands for that same phenomenon of self, of the self-sense applied in on a cosmic scale, on a universal scale. Through Ya, Purusha is produced. Purusha, the person. And always remember that throughout all Upanishadic literature, the first and fundamental meaning of Purusha is he in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. That must never be forgotten. True Na is Bhagwan, the Lord, produced. The embodied creative power of the universe. Sri Krishna is called Bhagwan himself. In modern times they have applied the term Bhagwan to Ramana Maharishi, the late Ramana Maharishi. It's not very wise to arrogate such terms to oneself. And it is not very wise to let others use such a term in relation to oneself. However, this sort of thing happens. When we get people assuming titles like Maharishi and so forth, and if they call themselves Mahadeva, they call themselves Mahesha, they are using the terms applied to the Supreme Being. In the old days, it was those who came in contact with the Holy Ones and realized that they were in contact with the perfected Holy One. It was they who bestowed that title upon him. But the Holy Ones themselves never arrogated any title unto themselves. So Bhagwan, the Lord, is produced through the syllable Na, and through Ya, Paramatma is produced. The Supreme Atma, not beyond Atma, but the Supreme Atma is produced. Now note that you get the entire range of all cosmic manifestation in every aspect of it, from the material to the spiritual, from the concretest to the most subtle, symbolized by these syllables. It's not that the utterance of the symbol, of the syllable, will produce a cosmos or some such thing. It's not that. These syllables, Om Namo Narayanaya, these eight syllables symbolize all this. So now, what is the significance of this teaching? In meditation, if one concentrates the mind, directs one's attention to all that is symbolized by those eight syllables, all in turn, and you can imagine what period of time must necessarily elapse for this when you sit for such a meditation, then your whole being is attuned to total reality in all its main aspects. See, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, Parabrahman, Paramatma, the Lord, everything is involved in this mantra. So the yogi sits in meditation, and the yogi, remember, has been well prepared. First, he has been through the entire discipline of purification, through the yamas, the moralities, the virtues, the niyamas, the religious observances, and so forth, through the postures and through the breathing. The postures and the breathing have as their primary purpose that discipline of the body, the whole psychophysical organism, in fact, because of which the organism will not obstruct the direction, the directing of attention to the Supreme Reality. That is the purpose of the asanas and the pranayama, what they call the control of the breath. Then comes the again a bad translation for pratyahara, the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. It is not a withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense, but such a training that when the senses function, and as the senses function, there is no uprising of either attachment to what is conveyed through the senses or aversion against that which is conveyed through the senses. This is the supreme meaning, the real deep meaning of pratyahara. Now, if one has realized that state, then one comes to the state of dharana. I said a word or two about it this morning. The upholding of the order, the eternal order inherent in the cosmos, ripta, the eternal order. There comes that state. And then the dhyana, which is the paying of attention, the being at one in ultimate samadhi with the total universe. Now in that state, if you intone the mantra Om Namo Narayanaya, what you do is to intensify to the uttermost degree all that is represented, symbolically represented, in those eight syllables. You intensify it because your mind is already completely in tune with it. You are holding all that in your own being. To use Sri Krishna's words out of the Gita when he talks to Arjuna, behold the whole universe in my single body. In the Gita it's put in a different form too. But in the body of the yogi is the whole universe. He is then the true microcosm in that state, but only in that state. In the ordinary state, if he's walking and talking with you or me and so on, well, he's like an ordinary man. Maybe quite a remarkable man, yes. But he's functioning as an ordinary psychophysical person. But in this state, he is the whole universe. So this state is intensified to the uttermost degree. What happens with such intensification? You remember yesterday morning talking about the purpose of our existence. I said one of the purposes is that the individual shall be the nexus, the focal point into which the transcendent energies flow in and flow out. You yourself in that state are completely transparent. You are completely void of everything that obstructs transcendent energies from functioning through you. Remember I said you are the grail of transcendence. Now, the grail of transcendence has to have the capacity to not to be shattered by the inflow and outflow of transcendent energies. You see, we know something of the enormous energy which is stored up, locked up in every single cell of our body, in every single atom making up that cell, and so forth. All is energy. That which is manifested as a particular living organism is an immense amount of energy stored up in a single vessel, so to say. And that vessel has to be able to withstand. That doesn't mean standing against, but to be able to endure the intensification of energies which are not nature's gift to us, but which we release through our yogic practice and through meditation. Now, if the person, a person, driven by ambition, by desire, by the longing to escape from this world and so forth, tries to use this sort of mantra as a shortcut, he will experience certain results, some of which may seem to be beneficial at first. But sooner or later, there will be great trouble. Of course, if he dies before the sort of appointed time, all right, he's escaped it. But if he doesn't, sooner or later there will be great trouble. Now why? Note carefully what I said. This process of meditation, this use of the mantra, intensifies everything. It intensifies everything, good and bad alike. And if that which is bad in us is also intensified, it is bound to find expression in some way or other within the living organism. If the situation is such, the circumstance is such, if it is provocative enough, it can disrupt the organism. One of the simple ways in which that disruption is shown is that the person begins to lose his sanity. He becomes insane. For example, he gets so imbued with the idea that I, the particular individual, Ram Lal, or whatever his name is, or John Smith, am God, in the entity style. And his interaction with his world becomes very troublesome to him, to others certainly, and also to him probably. That is one aspect of it. But there are other aspects. There can be serious illness and death. If you misuse such energies, there mustn't be this intensification taking place through the deliberate desire to achieve something for oneself. It will all happen naturally if one lives the religious life in the truly religious sense. That is to say, in the sense in which there is no selfness at all. You find, for instance, in Zen teaching, how it is said, let the mind utterly perish, let the self utterly perish. They put it in such extreme terms. It's in Huang Po, is it? Any Zen scholar? Yes. Let the self utterly perish. It's put in very strong language, liable to be misunderstood, therefore. But until that selfness, let selfness utterly perish, then the situation is different. But when has selfness utterly perished? What is the starting point of it? The starting point of it is the pure life. The utter purification of the psyche of all defilements. That is why these yoga Upanishads are full of lists of obstacles to yoga, listing out the moral and intellectual defilements. Look, Patanjali, for instance, lists in the obstacles to yoga: disease or illness, dullness, doubt, carelessness, sloth, worldly-mindedness, false notions. This is the intellectual part of it. Missing the point, instability of nature or character. These are accompanied by pain, despair, nervousness, disturbed inspiration and expiration, breathing. That comes in the first section of the yoga aphorisms, verses 30 and 31. In the second section, verse 3, ignorance, the isolative ego sense, asmita. Desire, aversion, attachment. These are the obstacles to yoga. And all this has to be dealt with before training the body, the psychophysical organism, to become the grail for receiving this transcendent energy. In the Upanishads, the Yoga Tattva, laziness, idle talk, association with bad characters, dabbling with mantras, indulgence with the opposite sex, a slightly universal practice maybe. In the Tejobindu Upanishad, absence of right inquiry or investigation, laziness, inclination to sense pleasures, absorption in mundane matters, sloth, distraction, impatience, absent-mindedness. In the Yoga Kundli Upanishad, discontinuing the practice out of fear of disease, doubt, carelessness, laziness, sleep, sensuality, delusion, lack of perseverance. And the Amritanada Upanishad lists fear, anger, laziness, excessive eating or fasting, excessive sleeping or waking. Those are the obstacles to yoga. And I haven't listed the whole lot. I mean, I've left out a good few. Now, we come to a very interesting point which we must really appreciate. We understand that the asanas are the means, the practice of bodily postures. And we think that the word asana is concerned only with the body, and that the word pranayama is simply concerned with the control of our breath rhythm as we breathe in and out. Now, there are psychological and spiritual counterparts to asanas and pranayama. The Tejobindu Upanishad says that should be known as asana or posture in which one can meditate uninterruptedly or undisturbed on Brahman with ease and without fatigue. That is the psycho-spiritual meaning of the word asana, according to the Tejobindu. The Tejobindu is a tremendously important Upanishad, very important indeed. In the Mandala Brahmana Upanishad, this is one where Yajnavalkya again comes in. In the Tejobindu, we have Kumara the Kartikeya, as he is called, asking the questions, and Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, himself answers. But I've explained several times, to most of you anyway, what the divine dialogue really means. It is you yourself, having realized certain things in the supreme condition, coming back to ordinary consciousness, represent the concepts and ideas and so forth which emerge afterwards in terms of a dialogue between you, the man in the world, and you, the seer in communion. That is how the divine dialogue originates. All through the Old Testament, the great prophets, when they say, and then the angel of the Lord came and visited him. The angel of the Lord typifies a particular aspect of our spiritual being and life. But it does stand for actual archetypal cosmic energies, factual energies, which science, of course, still doesn't know. which some people have believed in and other people just reject as imagination. But never mind that. We know that these archetypal energies do function. So the angel of the Lord represents that. And the different names of the angels, archangels, the devas, the suras, the asuras, and so forth, stand for different types of manifestation of this primordial creative energy, the ultimate source and body and goal of the universe. So the Mandala Brahmana Upanishad, there is this: being firm in the unshaken spiritual wisdom constitutes posture. The body is not mentioned at all. Being firm in the unshaken spiritual wisdom constitutes posture. This is the purely spiritual counterpart of the physical asanas. Then with respect to pranayama, in the Tejo Bindu, that is called pranayama, control of the breath as it is usually translated, in which there is the control of the modifications of the mind through the cognition of Brahman in all states of consciousness. That means this, that he who has awakened to reality, he who has become enlightened from within himself, once he has realized through living experience this unio mystica, to use the Western term, once he has realized that, he never loses the awareness of totality as a background, of the absolute as a background. All that is relative for him in his daily life is rooted in that absolute. This is one of the most wonderful things that happens to one who leads the religious life. To put it in theistic terms, God is ever present within you, ever present within you, and is the root out of which everything that you think, feel, speak, and do in terms of the relative, of the particular, in the world of duality and multiplicity emerges. You see? So, pranayama is the control of the modifications of the mind through the cognition, he calls it. It would be better perhaps to say through the awareness of Brahman in all states of consciousness. Note carefully, all states of consciousness. The avoidance of being impressed by the phenomenal world as if it were not the relative but is the absolute is said to be expiration, rechaka, breathing out. This is the psychological correspondent of outbreathing. The awareness, aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. I think it would be much better to say Brahman is me. The awareness, aham brahmasmi, only is inspiration. Puraka, breathing in. Remember, when you breathe in not only the oxygen, nitrogen, etc. mixture, which we call air, but you are taking in life energy in its concrete form, air. It is life energy which is involved. The constant retention of this awareness without any agitation is the retention or cessation of the breath, kumbhaka. You find these three elements spoken of in all the works on yoga, inspiration, expiration, and the retention of the breath. And if you read these Yoga Upanishads, and I remember a tremendous shock I had when I read that you retain the breath for periods like 48 minutes, one muhurta as they call it, you see. And they even go on to say there is the cessation of the breath. Well, how on earth can the physical body survive if there is a complete cessation of breath? So now this Kumbhaka is really to be understood in this form, the constant retention of the awareness that the totality functions through me, sustains me, and so forth. If that is always with you, it means that you retain the life energy. The word prana is a difficult word. It's used in several senses. In its simplest and most concrete sense, prana is, of course, your breath, the physical breath, air going in and coming out. But prana means life energy from the concretest, from its concretest manifestation to its supreme manifestation as Brahman itself. The Chandogya Upanishad, that famous sentence, Brahman is prana. How can Brahman be just an oxygen-nitrogen mixture? And only that. Brahman is the oxygen-nitrogen mixture, and it is also an infinity more than that. Such is the practice of the enlightened. The ignorant merely close their nostrils. You know, practice of this retention, to close your nostrils, or suffer from nose ache. The Varaha Upanishad says, taking his stand on himself, when Brahman is seen, rejecting everything caused by ignorance of the Atma is rechaka, expiration. Rejecting everything caused by ignorance. That is to say, having nothing to do with all those illusions and delusive ideas which rise up in the mind about ultimate reality and so forth. Rejecting all that is the outbreathing. Absorbing the wisdom of the scriptures is inbreathing. Absorbing the wisdom of the scriptures and keeping oneself in the knowledge of Brahman is Kumbhaka, the retention of the breath. And if you and I so live that we are never unaware, as a background, as a ground of our daily existence, never unaware of the total reality as such, then that is Kumbhaka. The in-breathing and out-breathing is a dualistic process. It's a fluctuation this way and that way. But it is a rhythmic movement. Wheresoever one is healthy, wheresoever one is poised, and so on, it is a rhythmic process. When the psyche, or the body, or the whole psychophysical organism gets disturbed, that rhythm of the breath gets disturbed. And you will notice, I mean, you'll all agree, it's a fact of our experience, that not only does the rhythm of the breath get disturbed, but our whole mental process gets disturbed, and any such awareness we may have of the cosmos in which we live, and its poise, its beauty, all that gets shaken. How easily the world becomes a place of turmoil. It becomes like a hell for us through our own particular sorrows and difficulties and so forth. Of course this happens. And this is why one must of necessity have deep compassion for the suffering of mankind. The great teachers knew all this. They were master psychologists. We haven't such psychologists roaming about the world in droves. Very rarely you find one such person nowadays. So those are the sort of psychological and spiritual counterparts. When all these are present, together with the disciplines as we ordinarily understand them, then pronounce your mantra. When you are in deep meditation, when you are in that state of attentiveness which is utterly pure and clean, then you will be a benediction upon the world around you. Otherwise, nothing can prevent you paying the penalty for the misuse of mantras.
The following discussion took place after the talk.
If there is no vested self-interest, you will save yourself from misinterpreting any of the effects that you feel. You see, there is always this tremendous problem with each of us. And no one else can help us because it all happens only inside us. Just as no one else can digest your food on your behalf. It's impossible. You see? It happens with all of us. We are conditioned in a certain way, therefore the mind will interpret all that we observe under the limitations imposed by that condition. It's impossible to avoid it. The limitations imposed by our conditioning upon our own self will color, will distort, will falsify the whole truth of what we think we are observing purely objectively. There is no such thing as a purely objective observation. Scientists always prided themselves on the fact that they observed purely objectively. And in this century, particularly in those Tana lectures of 1938, Arthur Stanley Eddington, Plumian professor of astronomy in Cambridge, giving his series of lectures, pointed out very clearly how scientists deceive themselves that their observation is totally disinterested and objective. It is, to a considerable extent, to an extent greater than most other observers in other fields. The scientist is considerably free from this wishful observation. But even the scientist is not totally free. And he pointed out clearly how, and interestingly enough, he used the symbol of a fisherman's net with the mesh, large or small, according to what he wanted to get. You see, he let through the evidence. There was a slight tendency to let through the evidence that wasn't sufficiently favorable or quite favorable to his particular hunch. He wanted to collect the evidence which would prove his hunch.
And this is where the trouble comes. That way, the truth gets distorted.
Extremely easy to do. Extremely easy to do with this analogy of the lead.
You see? So, this pure observation, if then you approach, if you can approach experimenting with the mantra, with that kind of utterly purified mind, then experiment with it. But otherwise, remember that if your voice is that sort, produces remarkable vibrations, if your voice is that sort, and if you repeat the mantra aloud, or if your mind is that sort, which can concentrate in such a way that it arouses, that it intensifies things inside you, then good and bad alike get intensified. You see, it's a little bit like the rain. It doesn't choose on whose field it will fall. It just falls, and it is unconcerned where it falls. Now, if I discover some ways and means of producing rain, I might be able to direct it on certain fields and keep it away from other fields. And if I am not a wholly benevolent despot and choose my favorites on whose fields I shall let the rain fall, there will be suffering, won't there? Those who don't get the rain will suffer. No, but this is a bad analogy, it's a misapplied analogy. Sorry. No. Cut it out. I hope you didn't record that.
Cruz, does this apply also if you're in a meditation center and there's Tibetan chanting? Does it also apply then if you're not actually partaking of it, but you know it's there?
But you are part of it all the same.
So does it still intensify, you know, the good and the bad in each
alike, yes.
The same?
This is something which people have not appreciated sufficiently, that it does intensify every aspect. Look, in the East particularly, we are brought up when we are, this is my own personal experience too, we are brought up to say our prayers, and you know, most of us, we do sort of say them in a sing-song manner, we intone them. And if by any chance our intoning happens to be musical and of the right sort, it intensifies every aspect in us. You see? And years later, after I finished at Cambridge, and had to struggle for existence in the outer world, you see, I began to notice curious things happening to me and curious modes of action and behavior by me. And I looked into this and wondered how and why and where does it all come from. And it was, of course, linked up with, amongst other things, the way I used to sit and say my prayers year after year till I was about 15 and 16. These Avastan prayers, I read your translations this morning, the Zarathustrian things, you see. And I happened to intone them in a, I think, in a manner which certainly produced effects, because I was conscious of them from my childhood onwards, you see. And I realized this, that's how I began to understand that everything which you do in that direction intensifies the whole of you, not just a part of you. See, it's like...
Is it like turning the electrical current up to make it so...
The current will, the electricity will work according to its own nature, and if you misdirect it, well, that which is not ready to receive the current, the voltage or whatever it is,
it breaks,
you see. This is the point.
At a lower level, musical chords will do this.
Yeah. I could tell you something which happened, again, a personal experience, but... Well, let me put it in its kindest form. This happened in the mid-1930s in London, soon after I had bought my present Steinway. There was a young man, he was not so very young either, who fell in love with a young lady who had a nice little fortune on her own. Not very much, but for those days, quite a respectable fortune. And this man knew about it. He sort of courted the young lady. And I don't think he really was serious about love in its pure sense, in its true sense. He and his first wife were divorced, you see. And they used to come and see me, and they were fond of music, not very much, but fond, it occupied. And one day they wanted to hear me play, particularly wanted to hear me play. And I don't know, I was in just that mood, and I played the Wallstein and the Passionata in succession. Within minutes after I finished playing, They said, excuse us, and they went home. You know the rest. A little later, I heard from my solicitor friend, who came to know them, that these two had got married and had come to him because they knew my solicitor friend's name through me. And that young lady's fortune was nicely in the hands of this man. You see how emotions got aroused. The young lady was not keen on him, but it so aroused both of them that they suddenly fell into the pit. And afterwards there was trouble and sorrow between them, and then the years passed. You see? This is a fact. Here in the one of the Yoga Upanishads, there's a description given of the disciplinary process with respect to eating and drinking and so forth. And it is stated, at this stage, the yogi's body becomes irresistibly attractive to the opposite sex. Darling. Not darling. I mean, some slightly unfortunate statement to put into the Upanishad.
You've spoken a lot on mindfulness, and I think it's the last group meeting that you said, apart from the mindfulness that we should be trying to practice every moment, that one could sit in meditation during the day and practice the same mindfulness, just watching thoughts and what comes up without judgment. Now, does this kind of meditation also have the same effect as a mantra? Would that also intensify both sides, or is it different? Or
yes, yes. This intensification process takes place always, but with mindfulness, there is another element introduced. When mindfulness is functioning as it should function, there is the free play of your unerring discriminative faculty. We don't need to be taught right and wrong. There is that in us which will tell us quite correctly, this is right, that is wrong. This is good, that is evil. When the mind is quiet. It is when the mind is unquiet, when it is perturbed, for any reason whatsoever, that the deliberate practice of mindfulness doesn't quite succeed. Otherwise, the mindfulness will be perfectly right. You see? Because when the mind is actively being mindful as such, our conditioning, our hidden repressions, all our unworked out mental impressions, the vasanas and so forth, they all come up to the surface and show themselves in their true light. Then you know, you see, all of the whole thing is remarkably complex, the way it all happens. No, that is quite a different thing. See, the more we understand this, the more we will appreciate why the great teachers, what fundamentally did they teach? Every one of them said, be harmless, be loving, be kind, be truthful, don't steal, don't run away with your wife, I mean with your neighbor. Well, I should put it this way, don't run away from your and so on and so on. You see, all these simple things. Well, did it need a perfected holy one to say all that? These are the accepted things, more or less, with varying degrees of elasticity, you see, as a social morality. because otherwise the society would be in complete chaos. Society enjoys a little bit of chaos because it gives them excitement. It gives them something to look forward to in their daily newspapers and so forth. But not to be serious about it. These things just you and I as ordinary sensible people, men of the world, the worldlings, know. It doesn't need perfected holy ones to say these things. But they said it again and again. It is on this that they laid the foremost emphasis. Look at the technique of self-discipline. That's one thing I forgot to talk about this morning in the Zarathustrian presentation. Very simply put forward, the whole morality is comprised in the three words, Hu-mata, Hu-upta, Hu-vrashta. The good thought, the good word, the good deed. Not goody-goody, but the good in the transcendent, absolute sense of the good which has freed itself from the limitations of the duality of good and evil, good and bad. It has freed itself from those limitations, and the third thing, the integrated, the living integration of these two different types of expression of your psychical energy have emerged as the absolute good. Then it is a great archetypal power. And it functions freely through you. Then you can handle power. I mean, most of you have come month after month, year after year to our group meetings, and you've heard me say this ad nauseam. Abjure power until there is the harmony of wisdom and love. Then you will not misuse power. Otherwise, inevitably, power gets misused. Only if politicians and such like understood this kind of thing, well, we probably would have no politicians then.
Lord Acton said it years ago.
What?
All power corrupts. Yes. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. Hmm.
But he didn't say this other part, which is the more important part. Until you have the harmony of love and wisdom, use power. You can use power rightly only when there is the harmony of wisdom and love. Therefore, abjure the pursuit of power. Abjure the acceptance of authority and such things. As far as it's possible to do that. It is not possible to do that in the world, simply because our ordinary life would come to a standstill if we carried it to the extreme. But bear the principle in mind, and don't rush into things, all in the name of doing good. Oh yes, I'll become president of this society for the protection of the rich against the poor, etc. All this rushing into do-gooding is just a preening of one's own ego and vanity.
Can't one possibly say that at a certain level, not only will there not be any misuse of power, but there cannot be misuse of power?
As far as the individual himself is concerned,
yes.
But the circumstance may be such that inevitably something will go wrong.
Yes.
You see, this is one of the very fascinating topics which has treated the great Kabbalistic writers through the centuries. Because you see, this problem of evil in its deep metaphysical aspect is a very, very difficult problem indeed.